This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm your co-host, Shobana Xavier, and I hope you are staying well and safe wherever you are, and thank you so much for joining us today. In our episode today, we are joined by Professor Ariella Marcus-Sells to discuss her new book, Sorcery or Science, Contesting Knowledge and Practice in West African Sufi Texts, which is published by the Pennsylvania State University Press in 2022. The book examines two Sufi Muslim theologians known as Quintus scholars who rose to prominence in the West Sahara Desert in the late 18th century. Siddi al-Mukhtar al-Kunti and his son and successor Siddi Muhammad al-Kunti both influenced the development of Sufi Muslim thought in West Africa. Through textual analysis of devotional aids, such as prayers or supplicatory prayers with du'as, we are provided a picture of their understanding of the realm of the unseen and the resulting practices of the sciences of the unseen. Marcus-Sells captures how Quintus scholars engaged with contested Sufi and Islamic praxis that contained cosmology, metaphysics, magic, sorcery, and occultism. The study also insightfully contextualizes the broader social and political context of the Saharan Desert, such as the transatlantic slavery, and how within this context, these legacies of devotional and magical practices within Hellenistic and Arabo-Islamic worlds are sustained. The book also provides a methodological intervention in the study of religion and how scholars construct boundaries around emic and etic categories, particularly when it comes to magic, especially in Islamic studies and broadly in religious studies. This remarkable book will be of interest to those who think and write about Africana religious studies, Islamic occultism, magic, Sufism, and Islam, and much more. In our conversation today, we talked a little bit about the methodological process that led to the writing of the book, some of the ways in which emic and etic categories of magic used in religious studies and in Islamic studies have hindered how we think about magic pejoratively, and some of the practices such as sand writing and sorcery, divination, and much more. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Ariella Marcus-Sells about her new book, Sorcery or Science, Contesting Knowledge and Practice in West African Sufi Text.
Hi, thank you so much for coming on to New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm so excited to talk to you about your new book, Sorcery of Science, Contesting Knowledge and Practice in West African Sufi Text. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited. I mean, this book is just such an amazing book and it's so fun. And I know it's weird to call it juicy, but it's like a juicy book. And so I'm like really excited to talk to you about it. I mean that in the best of terms, right? Like just a good book.
I'm so glad that you liked it. It's always a pleasure to hear that.
Yeah. Can you let us know a little bit about yourself, your intellectual journey, and what led you to writing this fantastic book?
Of course. So the research for this book started when I was at Stanford, so during my PhD research. And even before I went to do the archival research, I had been, you know, I'd been reading a lot about West African history, the history of Muslim societies and communities in West Africa. And I kept noticing these names, the names of Sidi El-Mukhtar Al-Kunti and the Kunta scholars would crop up in secondary literature on the history of the region, but almost always as like a footnote or an aside that was about another scholar. And people would say, oh, and so-and-so was influenced or so-and-so was connected to, you know, the great Sidi El-Mukhtar Al-Kunti. But then they wouldn't really talk very much about those people. But it seemed that Sidi El-Mukhtar and his family had somehow influenced almost every single major Islamic figure in the region for like a 200-year period. And then I went to do some preliminary research in Mali in 2010, and I went to the manuscript libraries, particularly in Timbuktu, just to get a sense of like what was in them, what I would find. And I found that they were full of what in the catalogs were called occult sciences or esoterica. And these texts were fascinating. They were filled with figures and diagrams and instructions, but most of them, the great majority of them, were undated. They had no provenance attached to them. They didn't have authors, they didn't have copyists, they didn't have dates, which meant that they were very difficult to contextualize. You couldn't attach them to a particular time period, a particular place, a particular context. Except there were ones that did have names attached to them. And those names were these names, the names of the Kunta scholars that I had seen cropping up in relation to all these other historical figures in the region.
Wow.
And so I was able to put the two together and say, oh, these people, which you know, Western academic scholars have not written very much about, but acknowledge are very important, were also important in these traditions, were involved in these traditions in some ways.
That's so fascinating.
Thank you. I also noticed as I was working on this topic, I had that kind of increasing frustration with both the people who were doing the kind of social and political history of Muslim communities and figures in West Africa, who, to my mind, really ignored the intellectual production of these figures, right? Their intellectual works. And some of them, you know, particularly some of the scholarship from like the 70s, 80s, and 90s, sometimes seem to kind of comb through these hagiographic works or these treatises in search of dates. And to discard the kind of cosmology and the hagiography and the metaphysics as irrelevant to the history of the region. And then on the other side, people who were doing kind of the intellectual history of Sufism, they often didn't seem to be particularly interested in the social context of the figures they were studying at all, and found that to be rather irrelevant or of very secondary or tertiary relevance to these kind of like abstract intellectual constructs. And I think one of the questions for me that motivates the book is, how are these things truly related? How do the social and intellectual worlds come together? How do they inform each other? How can we think more fruitfully about the importance of both of them? And then finally, there was the history of magic. So when talking about these things, one of the first questions that comes up is, well, how do you talk about it? What terms do you use to talk about it? Or can you only use the kind of transliterated Arabic emic terms? And I had a very long journey in this. So, you know, when I first wrote the dissertation, I actually was reading all of this criticism of the kind of colonial origins of, you know, the distinction between religion and magic in religious studies. And I came to the conclusion that, oh, I had to completely reject this terminology entirely. And then in the last 5 years, 5 to 7 years, there's just been this explosion of research and interest in the history of magic and the history of magic in general, like within religious studies, but also within Islamic studies. And reading that and engaging with that research really changed my thinking on this. And I ended up connecting this to this new scholarship on the development of the history of magic that goes all the way back to ancient Greece and develops from there. And I'd like to think that the book makes a contribution to understanding the relationship of Islamic traditions to that larger history.
Yeah, no, and I think that's what's just so fascinating about the book. And I love that the book is about the unseen and the seen, because I think they play a perfect metaphor or symbolism for exactly what it is that you're doing, which is like bringing together these disciplines that some of them have been treated very pejoratively, right? As you're saying, like the idea of magic and religious studies, and then also perhaps not attended to in Islamic studies, right? Kind of tied to sorcery and all of this other stuff. So I think the book is like remarkable theoretically for that reason, because it's just so insightful in bringing these different disciplines together. And then there's the actual case study that you're working on too, right? Which is the story of West Saharan Sufism, right? Which I think is so cool. So many things are going on here, which I'm really excited to get into. Can you talk a little bit about your archival journey? Like you mentioned a little bit. I know archival, I'm an ethnographer, so I have my own anxieties about going into the field, but the more and more I speak to archivists, like the more that I find that there's like other particular sets of challenges and like interesting moments. And so I don't know if you had particular challenges, like where did this book project take you, your dissertation project take you in terms of looking for archives? What were like some challenging moments, but maybe like what was like a surprising good moment that you were like, oh, this is great?
So one of the largest challenges was that I had initially been planning to spend 6 months in Timbuktu. So I did a preliminary trip in 2010, and I was planning to return in 2012 to do 6 months of research in the manuscript libraries of Timbuktu. And then at the end of 2011, the kind of civil war in the north broke out.
Right.
And it was impossible to go to Timbuktu. So I reoriented, and I ended up spending 1 month in Djenné at the La Bibliothèque des Manuscrits de Djenné, the manuscript library of Djenné. And then I spent 6 months in Morocco instead, primarily in Rabat, looking at the manuscript libraries there. And then 1 month in France at the Bibliothèque Nationale, which still has the contents of the former library of Ségou.
Oh, okay.
And I discovered that there were some really interesting manuscripts in Djenné, and it turned out that there were a lot of Kunta manuscripts in Morocco, far more than I had expected or hoped for. And so most of the manuscript texts that this book is based on are housed in Morocco. Mm-hmm. I think one particularly, one challenge that faces a lot of people who do manuscript research is in getting reproductions of these texts that, so that you can really spend a long time reading them at home, because it often takes, you know, it often takes weeks or even months to work through a single one of these. They're old, they're complex,
right?
The handwriting needs to be deciphered along with a lot of other issues.
Yeah.
And kind of negotiating that process with each library. I had a very positive experience at the manuscript library in Djenné, where I was one of the first foreign researchers to come and use the library. And they had a wonderful setup where they where many manuscript libraries actually purchase manuscripts from individuals who had passed them down in their families. And they didn't do that. They actually stored, they housed manuscripts that continued to belong to their to the families that had owned them. And each family's collection is kept and housed separately. So I was, because I was one of the first people to come in and use the library, I worked out a system with them for obtaining reproductions where I paid a fee, which was then split between the library to, you know, support their efforts to house and preserve the manuscripts and between the family that owned each manuscript that I was getting a reproduction for. And it felt very... it felt relatively open and transparent, and it felt like it was being used to really benefit the people who these works belonged to.
Right, right. Yeah. That's so fascinating. And especially with kind of social moments or like just political realities that shift research, right? Even when you're working with manuscripts. So I wonder, we could start getting into some of the pieces of the book. So the book is really around two main figures, right? And then kind of some of the things that they produced. And so two Sufi Muslim scholars who lived in the West African Sahara and Saharan desert in the 19th century. So can you tell us a little bit about these two scholars so that we can get into some of the things that they're doing that is informing the scholarship?
Absolutely. So El-Mokhtar El-Kunti and his one of his sons who became his heir and the leader of his community after him, Muhammad El-Kunti, were West African Sufi Muslim scholars. El-Mokhtar lived in the late 1800s, so the second half of the, I'm sorry, the late 1700s, the second half of the 18th century. He died in 1811. And he was somebody who came to prominence through trade. So he slowly acquired control over very important Saharan trade routes and amassed a large quantity of wealth, but he also became known for his scholarship and for his access to specific to the shrines of his Sufi ancestors. So he became known as a Sufi figure as well, and as a Sufi friend of God, so a figure of particular proximity to God. And because of his particular proximity to God, marvelous events would occur in his presence. He was also a teacher of students, so he developed a pedagogical network and attracted students from across the region who came to study and learn with him. And his son took over after his death and died himself in 1826 and was really the caretaker of his father's legacy. So he wrote the main hagiographic works about his father's life. And one of the things that differentiated these two from the Sufis in the region that came before was their involvement in social and political affairs. So many of the figures who, the West African Sufis in the region before were ascetics. Who lived in isolated communities, who had withdrawn from the world, and who passed down prayers, these supplicatory prayers, from generation to generation, often prayers that were attributed to founding figures, paradigmatic figures from the past, or that they had composed themselves and were attached to their own names. Much of El-Mokhtar El-Kunti and Muhammad El-Kunti's works defend what they call earning a living and being involved in the world. And so they became known for getting involved in the political machinations of other large Confederate groups in the region, and of supporting particular leaders or contenders to leadership positions. They also came to power in a time when the transatlantic slave trade had been going on for, at that point, several hundred years, and had gradually destabilized areas further and further into the interior, to the point where political leaders who had been charged with, in theory, protecting their subjects, the people under their dominion, were no longer able to do so, or had in fact fallen into slave raiding themselves and were preying on their own peoples. And this instability and constant threat of enslavement led to different political developments, and particularly a wave of Muslim-led movements that aimed to establish Muslim states. Mm-hmm. So there were a couple different models of political authority in the region, but almost all of them were based on coercive force, military power, and dominance. And Sidi al-Mukhtar and the Kunta, they were involved in an experiment, an attempt to establish a basis for social authority that did not rely on military force. This was a rhetorical fiction. They absolutely did resort to military force at times.
Right.
But they based their legitimacy in theory on something else, on the voluntary submission to the Sufi Friends of God, that people would recognize their authority, their proximity to God, and voluntarily submit to their leadership.
Right.
And part of their engagement in, you know, what we're about to talk about, these kind of contested practices, is certainly tied to that project, mm-hmm. to saying that they had some kind of method for controlling the material world around them, for influencing social and political events, and for protecting the people who had voluntarily, willingly chosen to submit to their authority.
Right. That's so fascinating. And this is kind of what you get into, I think, in chapter one about, which is kind of the visible world, right? Like kind of the social contacts, the political contacts of the desert reality of like what's going on at the time, right? And I was really kind of fascinated in this chapter about like the role that Sufism played in kind of the organizational and intellectual tradition that they're trying to kind of construct. So I wonder if you could talk us through this a little bit, because, you know, the reality is the visible is informing the invisible work that they're doing. And so much of it is the kind of political realities, the role of the saints, right? Let's could tackle that first in terms of some of the things you're doing in chapter one.
So one of the main arguments in chapter one has to do with how we think about Sufism and the history of Sufism in this region. And a lot of discussions about Sufism today are dominated by discussions of the Sufi orders, what are called the Sufi orders. These are large scale, hierarchical, oftentimes transnational organizations that have one Sufi figure, one Sufi friend of God, sometimes referred to as a Sufi saint, at the top. And then a hierarchy of kind of lieutenants, of leaders beneath him, stretching all the way down to kind of local initiates and followers. And these are particularly prominent and predominate in Senegal, although other parts of West Africa, including Mali, which is right next door, they are far less important. Mm-hmm. And because they are so prominent both in Senegal and elsewhere in the world, a lot of scholarship has tended to see the presence of Sufi orders in the past, even when the evidence does not support them being there. So the Sufi orders today, like I said, they're very large, they're often very large, they're hierarchical, they're very organized. But also a lot of people refer to them as having kind of a corporate and exclusive structure. So they all have names. So for example, one large one would be the Tijaniya and another one is the Qadraiya. And if you are a member of the Qadraiya Sufi order, then in theory, you can go to like your local Sufi, your local Sufi Zawiya, your local Sufi lodge in wherever you are. But also if you're traveling, you can go to your local Qadraiya Sufi lodge anywhere else.
Right.
And have more or less a similar or a very similar experience there and would be welcomed. And you're only supposed to have membership in one. They're exclusive. If you're a member of the Qadraiya, you're not a member of the Tijaniya. Right. And you would not be welcomed there in the same way, at least. And in the period in which the Kunta lived, in which Mukhtar al-Kunti and Muhammad al-Kunti lived, there's no evidence for the existence of orders like this. So I'm arguing that we need to understand what it meant to be a Sufi as being something that changed over time. Even though many of the Arabic terms associated with that are the same terms, how people understood those terms changed. These are kind of polyvocal, polyvalent words that were flexible, were adaptable. To be a Sufi when Mukhtar al-Kunti rose to power primarily meant to be an ascetic and to hand down these prayers, these supplicatory prayers from a figure that they felt a close spiritual connection to. And Mukhtar al-Kunti had a close spiritual connection to Abdul Qadir al-Jilani. But that didn't mean that he saw himself as the leader of an organized Qadiriyya Sufi order at the time.
Right. It's so fascinating. This chapter really, I think about Sufism a lot. And so this chapter really was important for me in terms of processing. I really love the way that you kind of were incisive in how you were thinking about Sufism based on the context here as well, and kind of made me pause and reflect on some of the ways that I think about it in my own context as well. So this is fantastic. So chapter two then gets into some really fun stuff and gets into the realm of the unseen. And here you're dealing with like the afterlife, cosmological realms, unseen entities. So what are, these two scholars that you're engaging with, like how, what do they think of these unseen seen realms? Like, why are they like even thinking about them, I guess, is a basic question I would have.
So there's no one place in their works where they just sit down and lay out the realm of the unseen, right? But they refer to it throughout. It's almost an assumption that it's one of these kind of fundamental assumptions that undergirds their worldview. And that comes forth in a lot of different places. And the more you read, the more it's clear that they assume that there is a realm of the invisible, an invisible realm, the realm of the unseen, alam-e-ghayb, that surrounds and interpenetrates into the visible material realm that we see and experience all around us. And that the entities, the invisible entities that populate the invisible realm, are constantly interacting with the material and the visible, and vice versa. The things that we do that are visible and material have effects, ripple effects out into the unseen. And that it's, for them, it's both crucial that we, that Muslims understand the unseen entities that are interacting with them all the time, but also that they align their behavior in the visible realm in such a way that they are then correctly aligned within the invisible as well. And it's important for physical and material protection, but it's also important for spiritual development as well. And it is salvific,
right,
as well.
Right.
And so it has all these important effects. Mm-hmm. So that is the subject of chapter two, is the invisible realm as it emerges from these texts in all these different ways.
Right. Yeah. And what was the role of saints in relationship to it? Because obviously there's like an intimacy and proximity that they were trying to situate that the saints had that perhaps the masses didn't. So like, yeah, what was that role, I guess? Yeah.
So as they lay it out, all believing Muslims have some contact and engagement and knowledge of the invisible realm. Whether that comes from prayer or whether that come from things like prayer or from knowledge in the Quran. The only people who were really cut off from the invisible were the unbelievers who had heard the message and completely rejected it, like turned their back on it. But for everyone else, everyone had some contact. And then the further along the Sufi path you went towards God, the deeper your knowledge of and your kind of awareness of the invisible realm became, until when you reached the ranks of the Sufi saints, of the friends of God, you gain something called test-free freedom of action, where you experienced the invisible to the same extent that we experience the visible and the material. You didn't have to learn about it. You were constantly immersed in it. And you didn't have to do something specific. You didn't have to perform a specific action or ritual in order to influence it. You could reach out and alter the invisible realm with your will, the same way that I can reach out and move the objects around me with my hands.
Right. Oh, so fun. That's amazing. And chapter three, I think you get to, I think one of the main crux of the, you know, the work that you're doing or the interventions that you're trying to make in this book and interrogating this idea of like the label, quote, air quotes, of sciences. And so here you're talking about things like crafting amulets or speaking with djinns or communicating with djinns, a use of maybe litanies and, you know, and a dhikr and things like that. And so there's a tension that you're trying to highlight, which is like, there is amongst the Kunta scholars that the idea of some of, you know, is this sorcery? Is this science? You know, what's going on here? And so there's kind of an internal conversation that's happening, but I think you're also placing this in the larger conversation of our field in religious studies and Islamic studies, right? And I think this is such an important chapter for that reason. So can you walk us through maybe some of the moves that you're making in this chapter?
Certainly. So one of the kind of methodological interventions in this chapter is to start with the internal terms, the emic terms that the Kunta themselves use to describe these practices, and to look at them at first at the first order categories and then at the second order categories. So to look first at each individual, what they would call science or discipline, and tease out what they are, but then also to look at how they categorize these groups of these disciplines, these groups of knowledge and practice relative to each other. So to work out their internal framework. And then finally, then at that stage, to come in with the kind of etic terms that that religious studies scholars have used to talk about these practices and to see to what extent they fit. So they are interested in engaging in certain practices, and they have ones that they valorize. And the most valorized of them they refer to as the sciences of letters and names. And these refer to the uses of the names of God and the letters of the Arabic alphabet, and also the understanding that each letter is associated with a number. And at one point, Sidi Muhammad says that the numbers inhabit letters the way souls inhabit bodies, right? That they are fundamentally connected. And in fact, the number is in some ways the kind of essence, that spiritual aspect of each letter in the invisible. So that allows for the function of, say, numerology. And they use these numbers and their letters and also some symbols to make charts and these squares that can then be inscribed on amulets or on physical objects that can be incorporated into other practices in various ways, to have almost an unlimited series of actions that you can do. So you can use them to cure a broken heart. You can use them to protect a house from thieves. You can use them to expel an unjust ruler from a city. You can really do almost anything with these. And they valorize them. And they need, however, when they go to categorize these practices, to distinguish them from two other groups of practices. So on the one hand are what are called the marvels of the friends of God, which are these charismatic gifts that God creates for his special friends. So causing, say, fruits to bloom out of season, or water to erupt from barren rock, or safety to emerge suddenly and unexpectedly in periods of danger. To do things like allow a friend of God to know what's happening in places that are very distant, or to be simultaneously in two places. And that happen in theory without doing anything specific. right? That happens suddenly and sometimes unexpectedly. So the Kunta want to distinguish what they call the sciences of the unseen, or the sciences of the secrets, from that category on the one hand, but also on the other hand from the category of sorcery, of seher, which they understand as real and as being absolutely prohibited. And their problem is that they acknowledge, Sidi Muhammad says in one text, that other Muslim scholars might look at these practices that we engage in and call them sorcery, but they are not sorcery. So he sees these as legitimate, permissible actions that Muslims can do. And in fact, sometimes he situates them as part of the Sufi path, as things that Sufis will do as part of their spiritual progression towards God, but that are not the marvels of the Friends of God at the same time. And one of the things that distinguishes them is that they are supposed to have predictable results. They are repeated things, and if you do them correctly every time, then regardless of the spiritual proficiency of the person doing them, they should work, which he says is just like sorcery. And the difference is that one is permitted and one is not. So he's trying to open up this space between the valorized, wondrous marvels, which are unpredictable, and the impermissible, prohibited actions of sorcerers, which, however, are predictable, repeatable in this way. And then finally, in this chapter, I take his discussion of the sciences of the secrets and their distinction from sorcery. And I connect that to a very old discussion that emerged in the Hellenistic world about magic, about mageia, and to discourses, Bern Christian Otto has called discourses of inclusion and discourses of exclusion. So the earliest discourses of magic emerged as a discourse of exclusion, what Kimberly Stratton called a discourse of alterity, that aimed to marginalize vulnerable groups, particularly women, but also foreigners, by marking them as other, as barbaric in certain ways. But even from almost the earliest time that we have evidence for that discourse of exclusion, it also seems that certain people took that label and said, actually, you know what? You're saying that this stuff is awful, but you're also saying that it's powerful. I'm going to try and grab that power. I am a magic user. I can do these things. And so Bern Christian Otto has called that a discourse of inclusion, and said that people who practiced the discourse of inclusion, who were self-identified magic practitioners, passed down their textual and ritual traditions in a heterogeneous but continuous tradition of Western learned magic. And he admits that the relationship between this tradition of Western learned magic and Islam is very understudied. But it is clear from the works of some other folks, including Leanna Seif, that much of this Hellenistic discussion of magic, both as a discourse of exclusion and also inclusion, was translated into Arabic as part of the Greek translation movement and adopted by Arabic-speaking Muslim discourse, where, you know, other things were added to it and it was changed and adapted over time. But offers a route by which these discourses came to be important within Islamic intellectual traditions and Islamic social history. And the Kunta are very much participating in these discourses, primarily through a discourse of exclusion. They identify magic as sorcery. It is always a negative thing. It is always prohibited. It is always impermissible. It is the domain of Muslims who are sinning or of non-Muslims. And in contrast, they try and build up their sciences as being something different, something outside of that domain.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think this chapter is probably like one of my favorites, but also I think just like a wonderful chapter that folks may want to consider using when they're doing religious studies and thinking about emic and etic categories, and especially around the ideas of categorizing magic, science, sorcery. This is just like so brilliant, and I loved every bit of it. And I think chapter 4 then takes, you know, some of those arguments further, and then also showcases how this, some of this is playing out in supplicatory prayers or du'as, right? And especially letters and the names of God. And you're doing something really intertextual, I think, in this chapter, and kind of pushing it a little bit further and almost circling back to some of the earlier arguments you were making in terms of like these devotional practices through prayers, right? And what it means in this context. So can you say a little bit about what you're doing in this chapter?
Absolutely. So I also love chapter 4. Actually, chapter 4 was the one that I wrote first. And one of the ones that I love the most. And it looks at this this genre of devotional text, of devotional literature, which absolutely fills manuscript libraries. Anyone who's worked in a manuscript library or archive knows that a large percentage of any manuscript library materials from any historical Muslim society will be these prayers, right? Which, and yet there has been so very little research done on them. And it's because they're really hard. So a lot of them in these libraries, like I said, I first encountered a lot of these and they don't have names attached to them. They don't have dates. So they're incredibly hard to contextualize. But even when they do have names and dates, they present obstacles because they don't have a kind of narrative explanation attached to them. You can't ask the people who wrote them historically, hundreds of years ago, how they understood them or what they did with them. And you can't, one of my kind of methodological points is to try and avoid reading back from what people do with them now and how they understand them now, and to avoid kind of imposing that on a past that was hundreds of years ago. Instead, I argue that we can draw out the meanings of these texts by reading them intertextually. So the first thing I do with these categories of devotional prayers is to situate each one within the Kunta's other larger narrative treatises on various levels. And when you do that, then each one seems to emerge as a kind of encoded and encapsulated summary of their longer metaphysical and cosmological discussions that is then easily memorizable and then can be transmitted orally among people who might not have access to the longer manuscripts or the time to read them or the knowledge, the training to read those longer, larger manuscripts. So this would allow their teachings to travel more widely and to circulate more deeply within a society than the paper, than the written works. But at the same time, when people are memorizing these, then anytime they come into contact with a person, who's attached to the Kunta pedagogical network, then each one of those can be unpacked, can be unraveled, can be decoded, can be situated within a larger discussion in this way. So you can see these as moments where the Kunta tried to encode and summarize and transmit their very complex metaphysical and cosmological understandings to a wide body of Muslim followers. But then the second thing I do in this chapter is to situate these texts that that Sidi al-Mukhtar and Sidi Muhammad composed, and to situate them in the context of other devotional prayers and devotional types of literature that we know was circulating in the region at the time. And when you do this, it is striking how similar they are. They are patterned on these earlier but still very very popular works, like the Dalal al-Khairat of al-Juzuli is one of the main comparisons that I make. And they talk about similar themes, but at the same time, they never repeat verbatim the prayers of these other works. Even though that kind of repetition, that kind of borrowing, was itself a genre convention. There were certain lines, certain prayers that were said to be handed down from the prophet or from these kind of paradigmatic early Sufi figures. And it was common to include those in new prayer works. So the fact that they specifically avoided doing so says something. They also have a much greater emphasis on cosmology and metaphysics within their own works. And from this, I conclude that the transmission, the circulation, and the recitation of these devotional prayer texts was already popular among Saharan Muslims at the time. And so they are trying to engage with, they're trying to mobilize that popularity, but attach it to their own name and their own authority, to their own lineage. So they're trying to get people to recite their prayers along with these earlier works like the Dalal al-Khairat. And therefore to kind of join their community and become part of their larger pedagogical network and become attached to their social authority as well. And doing that, it is very much related to what I'm trying to do in chapter one, because doing that illustrates that the social context for what people are doing and how people understand what it is to be a Muslim is not solely a matter of intellectual elites who come up with these theories and then try and impress them on the masses, right? On their followers. They are certainly trying to do that. They would like to do that, but actually often the popularity of certain practices pushes upwards and forces people who are elite, these elite scholars, to engage with them, to adapt them, to try and shape them. And in doing so, that shapes the larger intellectual products, the larger kind of metaphysical and cosmological treatises that these scholars produce as well. That those two motions are happening at once. Scholars attempting to shape the popular social environment, and then the popular social environment actually shaping the intellectual works of the scholars.
And I love that you were able to get us to think about that through prayers, like through these like really fascinating prayers, right? Which you've provided amazing, some of them at length. And so it was really like fun to read and then kind of contextualize in the broader context. I can now get why you love this chapter, because I also really loved reading this chapter. It was just like such a great way to, I think, also end the book as well. I have a few questions, you know, some just out of curiosity, like, so are these practices, like, what's the context of some of the things that you're talking about in this book in the contemporary moment? Like, are they, you know, what are the legacies of them, right? Yeah, I know that's not what you're doing, but I am kind of curious about it, yeah.
And there is a little bit of there's a short discussion of that in the conclusion as well. These practices are still incredibly popular and widespread across throughout Muslim communities in West Africa. And they are incredibly debated, right? There are intense debates over them throughout the region. At the moment in the region, there are figures who are called in French marabouts, right, which is based on a kind of French colonial mispronunciation of the Arabic murabet, but they are people who engage in these practices. They are kind of they're service providers. They're kind of textual ritual service providers that you can go to when you have a problem. And many, although not all of them, are also Sufis, right? And in certain places, some of many of them will be members of the kind of contemporary Sufi orders, but not all of them are. Some of them are not. But there are also many Muslims who reject these practices, who do see these practices as sorcery or as simply ineffective, as superstition. And many Muslims in kind of a transnational context, kind of globally, reject these practices as either sorcery or superstition. And so many of the transnational Sufi orders, while their members might engage in these practices, they tend to say that they need to be kept a secret, and that they need to be closely guarded, and they often kind of try and downplay the importance of these practices, especially when they're looking at a kind of more global or transnational audience. The kunta today, the kind of current kunta, are absolutely associated with these practices, and their legacy is bound up in them. So there's actually a saying in the region, a popular saying, actually, that if you want this kind of knowledge, you go and ask the kunta, right? And there's a kind of a line between the popularity and engagement of these practices among kunta descendants in Mali with their kind of disapproval among kunta descendants who are, say, living to the north of in Algeria, which also shows you how kind of different social and political contexts can affect how these practices are seen within a given community, even within a given community.
That's so fascinating. And this is just a random question. What is sand writing? I know we kept coming up in the book.
Oh, Hotel Ramo?
Yeah, I know, sorry, this is random, but I kept being like, I need to ask, what is this?
So, Khatal Ramal, as it's practiced today, sometimes called geomancy, is a form of making a series of marks in the sand that are generated, that are theoretically generated randomly, and then of interpreting, of reading a particular situation or determining what the outcome of something will be based on those marks.
Okay. Yeah, that's so cool. I think because most of the others I've kind of heard about.
Yes, you're right. I didn't like. So one of the challenges. So that is what it is today and how it is practiced today. One of my methodologies in this book is to not assume what any specific term might have meant, based on contemporary practices or practices from other regions. So unless I can tell, unless the kunta themselves explain what something means within one of their texts, I try to avoid assigning it a specific meaning. And that's very hard in some points, especially when they simply assume that their audience knows what they're talking about. And I would say Khatel Ramal is one of those, where I'm fairly certain it refers to this practice of making these marks in the sand and then using them as a kind of divinatory tool. But they do not ever explain it explicitly in the text that I read.
Right.
So that's one reason why I'm a little more hesitant to get involved in that, where they actually talk about and explain the magic squares and the terminology around the magic squares much more extensively.
Right, right. And for that reason, I mean, what you've done is that it's so accessible that if folks don't know some of these practices, especially the chapter on magic squares, to see the actual squares and to like the captions that were included, it's like quite accessible. And so I think for me, I was like, ooh, what is this thing? And what is that thing? Right? Because it's kind of really fun. But you're dealing with texts that are hyper-specialized. And as you're saying, just making the assumption that folks know, but as a reader reading your analysis of it, I found that I was able to access the context that you're talking about quite well. And so that's really a testament to you as a scholar to be able to make that accessibility possible. So yeah.
Thank you so much. I really, you know, that actually means a lot to me that you say that, because I try and write in a way that is accessible. I'm always doing it. I'm always trying to work on it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you're dealing with something like this, it's really hard, yeah. Right? Because in order to make it meaningful, you have to know so much about the specific terminology, the specific historic context, but also about Sufism and about the history of Sufism, and then about the history of these specialized practices, about magic discourse in Islamic traditions. And there were definitely moments when I felt like I gave up. And I said, you know what? This passage might not be accessible for non-specialists, or like this chapter, maybe I can't do it. Right. So actually to have somebody say, no, actually it felt very accessible, that means a lot to me, because a lot of effort went into that.
Yeah, no, and I could tell, like, because I know that to be able to do that required work on your end, right? Because it's not something that you just happens naturally. It has to be intentional about it. And I say that partly because I was nervous reading the book because I'm, you know, entering a field that I don't really know. But then I came out being like, right? Like I felt like I got a lot. And I'm sure those folks who have specialized training will probably get another layer that perhaps I wasn't able to get. And that's fine. But I still felt like I walked away with so much, right? So, yeah.
Although you do know a lot about Sufism and Islam. So I wonder, I'm like, but could somebody who studies like contemporary Buddhist movements in Hawaii, right? Would they find this accessible, right? Right. Or even, yes. So that'll be the real test. Yeah. I really hope so. I really tried.
Yeah. But. And I think they will, partly because, as you said, the chapter on kind of chapter 3, discussing the theoretical interventions you're making, that's just, you know, that's for so many scholars doing all of this work, either in the context of, you know, like maybe even like occult sciences in the North American context or the European context, right? This is getting into this whole other metaphysical reality, which I think, you know, people should read. And I think for someone who thinks about a lot of this stuff and in Islam and Sufism, I often get sad that that's not a thread. Like, you know, the work that you're doing, the work that Liana Saif are doing, I think those are things that need to be highlighted, but often in Islamic studies is not, you know, amplified as much, right? Yeah.
I also just want to take another moment to issue a shout out to Liana Saif for all of her like incredible, absolutely incredible like work that she has done on the intellectual history of these practices.
I'm dumping on that as well. Yeah, because I adore her work and I love the work that she's doing, and we're also indebted to her, right?
Like, this yeah, is absolutely. No, I honestly, I could not have written this book had she not done the work that she did. Like, she is just so many of her work. She has so many of them, so that I couldn't cite them all, but so many of them are just cited throughout and just served as a critical foundation that. Almost all of this is built on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. Well, Liana, if you're listening, we love you.
Yeah, we love you, Liana. Absolutely. We do. Yeah. What we were just talking about, though, the, you know, how I hope this book will be relevant to scholars outside of the study of Islam or the study of Sufism or the study of West Africa is also one of the arguments, is because of one of the arguments I make at the end of chapter 3, where I compare, you know, I connect this history to what Otto called these magical discourses of exclusion and magical discourses of inclusion. But then I connect that theoretical framework to another, which was developed by scholars like Peter Pels, but also Edward Bever and Randall Stiers, who referred to something called the double gesture, where a discourse of they don't use that word, a discourse of exclusion, but I'm connecting the two, where the process of rejecting forms of knowledge and the practices that are built on them actually reinforces and reinscribes the authority and the power of that authority and knowledge, and then makes it available for others, right? Such that the two become inextricably bound together. And in fact, often the people or the society that is doing the act of exclusion, they are the ones whose legacy becomes kind of almost continuously followed, almost haunted by the knowledge and practices of the people that that they've been trying to reject this whole time. And one thing I do at the end of chapter three is that I argue, so Pels and Bever and Stiers, they argue that this is a feature of the modern West, right? And I use the story of the Kunta in West Africa to say that that is absolutely not the case, that they are involved in the same thing, involved in this process of exclusion that ironically reinforces these the potential power of these forms of knowledge and practice, and then binds them all the more to their own legacy. And that in looking at that, we can see that this is not a kind of discourse, this isn't a process that is confined to the modern West, that this is actually a process that holds for all human societies who try to define or limit the sphere of legitimate knowledge and the effective and efficacious practices that are built on legitimate knowledge. That all of us, when we try to exclude or marginalize the knowledge and practices of people that we consider others, bind ourselves all the more closely to them.
Yeah. And I think it's precisely for that reason that I think this is such a great text for like theoretical, like to training students in terms of theory and thinking about religious studies and Islamic studies. I think you've hit it right there, right? And we don't do that. And so when you are giving us this kind of all of these conceptual things to think about, I think it's just so valuable because all of these categories we've constructed are really just kind of binding us in different ways, and we need to be really reflexive about it. So I think it's amazing. It's fantastic. And I can't congratulate you enough on a fantastic book. And I can't recommend it enough for our listeners to go and pick it up and read it and swim in it and have fun with it. It's really, really great. So I hope you are taking time to breathe and celebrate the book. But I know we're all academics and I know it's the summer. So hopefully, the summer is coming.
I have the summer, and also I'm on sabbatical next year.
Oh, congratulations.
Fantastic. Thank you. I got tenure
this congratulations. Past
year. Thank you. Oh, and wow. And I'm taking a post-tenure sabbatical.
Oh, congratulations.
Which I hope to use both, like you said, to rest and to breathe, but also to start the next project.
So tell us about, I'm celebrating your resting and breathing. I think we need to celebrate that for each other more.
Absolutely.
And
congratulations
on your tenure. That's amazing, amazing news. So after the resting and the celebrations are happening, what's the next project that you're thinking about?
So I just received a Kaoric multi-country research fellowship.
Oh, wow.
To go to Morocco and Mauritania and Senegal to research so the next project is about the narratives that developed in the early 18th century, so the early 1700s, about the War of Nasser ed-Din, which is referred to in the region as Shir Buba, Buba's War, which happened in the 1670s. Mm. And this was a Berberophone-led messianic movement around the figure of Nasser ed-Din, and the outcome of, and according to the narratives of it that developed, the outcome of this conflict, his defeat, formed the kind of social charter for social relations and hierarchies and political divisions in the region all the way up to the contemporary period. And even though this conflict is referenced in almost any work on the history of the region, there's actually no study just of the conflict itself. And I strongly suspect, I'm going to look, but I strongly suspect that documents that are actually contemporary with Nasser al-Din's movement either don't exist or are going to be very, very hard to find. And what I'm interested in are the narratives about the movement that were written by a scholar named Ilya Daly in the early 1700s that became foundational and helped establish the link between Sufism and revolutionary ideology that then served as the kind of revolutionary foundation for all of the Muslim-led military movements, the jihads of the 18th and early 19th centuries.
Whoa, that sounds amazing. Okay.
Yeah, it also sounds like maybe perhaps way more ambitious than the project will actually end up being.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about it. It's a different project. So for the moment, I'm not intending to do more work on the Kunta right now. I've been, you know, working on that project for 10 years. I'm ready to do something else. It goes earlier. I want to kind of go deeper into the pre-colonial period. And yeah, I'm really excited to look at Sufism and messianism and revolution.
That sounds so exciting. I'm excited for you, and I'm excited for us to be able to be the recipients of whatever wonderful scholarship that emerges out of it. Again, congratulations on everything, on tenure, the book, the sabbatical, the funding, and all the best for everything that's ahead of you. So thank you so much for hanging out with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Shobana. It was really a pleasure.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Ariella Marcus-Selves about sorcery or science, contesting knowledge and practice in West African Sufi texts. I hope you enjoyed that conversation, and I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, stay well and take care.